privilege to introduce our talker, our speaker today. I am informed by our speaker that I have gone to great lengths to get him here. And it is only due to my diligence, my wonderful effort. The accolades all go to me. So if you enjoy his talk, be sure and thank me. If you have enjoyed the archives presentation over there, be sure and thank me. If you haven't seen them yet, go over and take a look, and then be sure and thank me. And with that, I give you Don.
Hey, Don. Good morning, everyone. I'm Don. I am an alcoholic. And I'll be the first one. I'd like to thank Craig for... I'd also like to start off by thanking Natalie L., Craig A., Bob R., out there registration, Dan O., and the rest of the 58th annual, District 22 Conference Committee for asking me to come up here and share with you guys this morning. I've been asked to share with you guys on a topic, I don't know if you know this or not, but it's a topic that's very dear to me, and that's the history of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Big Book. And what I'm going to be talking about this morning, because this is a topic or a workshop meeting kind of, I felt like I had license to take some notes. So I wrote some things down. I'll be referring to my notes. I'll also be reading a few things to us which are of interest. And I'm sure there's some of you already saying to yourselves, Don, go home and read that stuff and just tell the story. But I'm going to read it anyway, guys, because it's important. This is a little bit different than coming up here telling my story, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. What I'm going to be talking about this morning is a little bit about recovery from alcoholism, which there was some, believe it or not, prior to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to be talking about the pre-AA days, the early AA days, the pre-Big Book days, whose idea the Big Book was. It wasn't Bill's, it was Hank P's, Hank Parkhurst. How the writing of the Big Book went, and a little bit about what happened after that. So it will be a what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. But it'll be about Alcoholics Anonymous and the Big Book. And I'm going to tell a couple of jokes. They're the same jokes. I'm not the comedian that was up here last night. He was a great speaker. But I find it to be a little bit difficult to come up here and talk about the history of recovery from alcoholism without talking first a little bit about the history of alcohol and the history of the consumption of alcohol. And my research is that the history of alcohol and the consumption of alcohol dates back to the clay tablets of the Babylonians. These tribesmen, they would plant their crops and they'd grow their crops, and when harvest time came, if they had a good season, they would take their crops and they would ferment their crops, and they'd make booze and throw big parties and have feasts and get drunk and go out and raid the other tribesmen's camps and cause fights and wars and steal their women and bring them back. Does anybody identify with that? That's back when we were writing in stone, guys. And in the Bible, there's the story of Noah. And if you read the story, I guess God was upset with humans. He was going to cause a big flood. And what he did was he caused Noah to build a huge boat, huge ship. And if you read the story, I guess that he put two each of his favorite animals on that boat. And the floods came and they went away. And if you read the story, the very first thing that Noah did when he got off that boat was he planted grapes. My kind of drunk. I think he planted grapes, got drunk, and barbecued the animals. We'll experience that this afternoon. You can already smell it coming through the doors. Anyway, what I'm going to be doing this morning is I'm going to be creating the links in the chain, that created Alcoholics Anonymous and gave every one of us in this room this morning a place to come to recover from our own alcoholism and our own seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And after having done the research that I've done, collecting archives and studying the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's very apparent to me that every link in that chain, up to and including every seat in this room this morning and every attendee at this convention, is a miracle. And I was listening to a friend of mine, a late friend of mine out of North Carolina, talk a few years back, and And Tom was talking about miracles, and I'm a guy that likes definitions, and he gave for me probably the best definition for a miracle that I've ever heard. What Tom said was a miracle is nothing more than what happens when preparation meets opportunity. And the two have to be divinely introduced, but the miracle happens when preparation meets opportunity. And I would venture to say that every one of us in this room this morning, man, when we got here, we were prepared. We were at a bottom beyond belief. Preparation met opportunity. The two were divinely introduced. The miracle happened, and we're sober today. And a lot of miracles had to happen in order for us to all be sitting here this morning. The history of Alcoholics Anonymous is very well chronicled. The book Pass It On is about Bill Wilson and his story and his writing. The book AA, the book Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers is a great history book on Alcoholics Anonymous. The book AA Comes of Age is a great history book on Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that AA Comes of Age should be required reading for every newcomer coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the things that I was told early on, very early on, was that, Don, if you're thoroughly convinced that your life depends on Alcoholics Anonymous, you should try to learn as much about it as you possibly can. And one of the things that I'm not going to be doing so much this morning is I'm not going to be talking so much about what's in those history books, but I'm going to be talking more about the links in the chain, of recovery. Anyway, we'll get this thing started. Back in the 1800s, the early 1800s, 1840s, there were six drunks. And these six drunks were sitting around a bar in Baltimore, Maryland, and the name of the bar was the Washington Inn in Baltimore, Maryland. And these six drunks decided one day that they were going to swear off alcohol. They also agreed to get a higher power. And one of the first things that these six drunks realized or discovered, if you will, one of the things that came up, first things that came about in the formation of Alcoholics Anonymous, was that they could stay sober together, but that they couldn't stay sober alone. And these six drunks did this, and this group became known as the Washingtonians, the Washington Temperance Society. This was in the early 1840s, and within 10 years, this group grew to number, depending upon which news article you read from the time, 500,000 people. That was 500,000 people here in the United States staying sober together. And I want to read a short clip to you out of this book right here. It's a real short clip. The name of the book is 10 Nights with the Washingtonians. It was written by T.S. Arthur. There's no printing date in this book. This book, it's estimated, it's by far one of the oldest books that I have in my library. But T.S. Arthur, when he wrote this, he says this, and it's about the Washingtonians. "Come," said a friend one evening in the winter of 1841, "let us look in upon the Washingtonians." "The Washingtonians," I replied, "and pray, who and what are they? Have you not heard about them?" "No." "Then you are ignorant of one of the most remarkable facts in the history of the times." "Explain yourself." "With pleasure. About 9 months ago, perhaps not quite so long, there were assembled in a drinking house in this city, Baltimore, six men, well advanced in years." In plain language, that means they were old. "Well advanced in years, who had for a long time been confirmed drunkards, or at least so wedded to the love of strong drink as to have found it almost impossible to live without a daily resort to its stimulating influences. Thus they had met accidentally, or rather without any other design in repairing to the bar room than that which had taken them there 100 and 100 times. But in the mind of each, there was a feeling of sorrow for his enslaved and wretched condition, a strong desire to rise out of it, yet a painful, hopeless sense of weakness. How often, alas, how often had each made resolutions of reform? How often had each renounced the cup of confusion only to sink again the bewildering draught and to sink still lower in the scale of human degradation? Thus they met as they had often met before, but neither seemed inclined to call for the subtle poison that had so many times stolen away their reason. Soon the feelings of each became known to the other, and they felt a sudden hope springing up in their minds, a hope in the power of association. Sad experience had proved to each of that little company that alone he could not stand, but together, shoulder to shoulder, hand to hand, and heart to heart, they felt that though the struggle would be hard, they could and they would conquer. And that's the Washingtonians. And one of the basis for our traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we've learned from other people's mistakes. And what happened was the Washingtonians had no roots. The Washingtonians had no traditions. The Washingtonians had no rules, for lack of a better word. And money, property, prestige, and power started to interfere. They started taking opinions on different political issues of the time. One of the political issues that they took an opinion on was alcohol reform. And the one that caused the factions to collapse was they took an opinion on slavery, and this divided the group, and the Washingtonians had failed. They were gone. Now, keep in mind that the Washingtonians were a very similar society to Alcoholics Anonymous, in that they started out with a singleness of purpose. They also had the Martha Washington Society, which was very similar to Al-Anon. I'm going to go now to the year 1895. 1895 is the year that Bill Wilson was born, so we're just prior to Bill's birth. There was a fellow by the name, in 1895, there was a fellow by the name of Sam Hadley. And Sam Hadley, I'm sure, how many of you have heard this talk before? You guys could probably give this thing. Sam Hadley was a chronic alcoholic who had gotten sober through a profound religious conversion experience. And it was notable. It was very notable. And there was a young, brilliant psychiatrist back then by the name of William James. And William James was writing a book now, a book about different types of conversion experience. And I'll tell you about him in just a minute. Now, in 1895, we didn't have the means of public communication and social media that we have today. There was no television. There was no radio in 1895. Newspapers were very sparse. There was no internet. You weren't going to like Sam Hadley on Facebook, and you weren't going to follow Sam Hadley on X, and you weren't going to watch Sam Hadley on TikTok. But I think that we can assume safely that if this was happening in one place in the United States, it was probably happening in others as well. And Sam Hadley had gotten sober through this profound religious conversion experience. There was a young, brilliant psychiatrist back then who was writing a book about different types of conversion experience, and this guy's name was William James. And William James wanted to write about an alcoholic, and so he wrote about Sam Hadley's profound religious conversion experience in this book right here. It's called The Varieties of Religious Experience. It was written by William James and published in 1902. This book, not this particular book, but this book happens to be the book that Bill Wilson read when he was in Towns Hospital, when he had what he called his white flash experience. And in this book, William James, like I said, wanted to write about an alcoholic, so he wrote about Sam Hadley's profound conversion experience. Now, Sam Hadley also had a son. And his son's name was Harrison Hadley. I have a quiz I'm going to hand out after this for all you guys. Make sure you remember these names. I'm going to ask you to log that name, Harrison Hadley. I'll tie Harrison Hadley into the links in the chain here in just a few minutes. I'm going to flash forward now to 1927. Bill Wilson is in the throes of his alcoholism. He's still successful at this point, but alcohol is becoming a major problem in Bill's life. He's starting to lose things. He's going to detox. Alcohol is becoming a major problem in Bill's life. And in 1927, over in China, there was a brilliant young minister by the name of Frank Buckman. Frank Buckman. And Frank Buckman had these great new ideas on Christianity and moral rearmament and different things. And while he was over there in China, he met up with a brilliant American young minister by the name of Sam Shoemaker. And Frank Buckman convinced Sam Shoemaker of this message he was trying to get across on moral rearmament and different things. And those two guys established what was to become the Oxford Group. And Sam Shoemaker came back here to the United States, and he was installed as the director of the Oxford Group east of the Mississippi River, east of the Mississippi River. And Harrison Hadley, I say east of the Mississippi River, there wasn't much out west of the Mississippi River in 1927. But Harrison Hadley, who Sam Hadley's son, he'd grown up just like his dad. I had to log his name. He'd grown up just like his dad. He was a chronic alcoholic. He couldn't get sober. But he knew that his dad had gotten sober in a mission. And so he began to think that if he could get to a mission, he could get sober and stay sober as well. And what he did was, Harrison Hadley had heard of Frank Buckman. He had heard of the Oxford Group. And he had heard of Sam Shoemaker. And what he did was he went and met with those two guys. And what he told them was, he said, you guys own an old mission down in the Bowery of New York. It's old, it's dilapidated, it's run down. How about if I go in there with a group of my people, clean this place up, make it usable, and under the direction of the Oxford Group, we'll get and stay sober there. And Frank Buckman and Sam Shoemaker told Harrison Hadley that that would be fine. So Harrison goes down to the Bowery of New York with a group of his people, and they clean this old mission up and they make it usable, and under the direction of the Oxford Group, they open the Calvary Mission. Now, the Calvary Mission becomes very important to us in Alcoholics Anonymous. The Calvary Mission is where Bill Wilson went to drag drunks out of to try to get them sober. The Calvary Mission is where Bill went to his first Oxford Group meetings. So I'm going to stop right here, guys. I'm going to recap this thing just a little bit so nobody gets lost. So far, what we have is we have the Washingtonians. From the Washingtonians, the message went to Sam Hadley. From Sam Hadley, it went to William James, the psychiatrist who wrote the book. It went to Frank Buckman and Sam Shoemaker in the Oxford Group. It went to Harrison Hadley, down to the Bowery in New York, and now to the Calvary Mission. We're still in the late 1920s. There's a young, rich drunk here in America, a guy by the name of Roland Hazard. And Roland was a rich kid. He's very wealthy. He was a drunk. He couldn't get sober. He tried everything that he could do to get sober and stay sober. He's very wealthy. He was the heir to the Allied Chemical Corporation, huge corporation back then. But Roland had tried everything that he could to try to get sober and stay sober, and he had no success. So his dad one day decides that he's going to send Roland over to Europe, Zurich, actually, to spend a year with the most renowned psychiatrist that we had in the world at that time. At that time, we had Freud and we had Jung, Carl Jung. So Roland goes over to spend a year with Carl Jung, and he learns all of this stuff. He learned everything you could learn about the thinking of the alcoholic, the psychiatry of the alcoholic, and he learned all this stuff, man, and he had it licked this time. And so Roland, he gets back on the boat, come back here to the United States. And I can't remember if it was on the boat or there shortly after, but Roland got drunk again. And he couldn't get sober. So his dad gathers him up, sends him back over to Europe, to Carl Jung, And Carl Jung told him this time. This was the first time that this was said. The next time it was said would be from Dr. Silkworth to Bill and Lois Wilson. But Carl Jung told him this time. He said, "Roland, with all my medical experience and everything I know about psychiatry and everything I know about psychology, I cannot help you. No human power can relieve your alcoholism." But he told him, he said, "Roland, that doesn't mean that you can't be helped. That doesn't mean that you're hopeless." He said, "There has been rare instances of profound religious conversion experience. You may be one of those that can do that." And so Roland, he got back on the boat. He came back here to America. And Roland had heard of Sam Hadley and Harrison Hadley and the Calvary Mission and the Oxford Group. And what Roland Hazard did was he went down to the Bowery in New York to the Calvary Mission, and he got sober there. And he remained sober. And one of the first things that Roland realized or discovered, if you will, another thing that came about in the formation of Alcoholics Anonymous, but one of the first things that Roland realized was that he had to pass this thing on. He had to be working with another alcoholic. He had to be carrying the message. And what Roland Hazard did was, Roland Hazard summered in Vermont. A lot of your affluential people out of New York have summer homes in Vermont. And Vermont's a very interesting place. Vermont is very important to us in Alcoholics Anonymous. Vermont is where Bill Wilson was born. Vermont is where Dr. Bob was born. And Vermont is where Roland Hazard summered. And what happened was, we're in the summer of 1934. Roland goes up to Vermont to spend the summer. He gets up there and he's got to find someone to work with and try to help with recovery from alcoholism. So he goes out and he finds himself two guys. And these two guys' names are Siebert Graves and Shep Cornell. Siebert Graves and Shep Cornell. Now, there's another fella that's spending the summer of 1934 up in Vermont, and I'm sure many of you have either heard his story or read his story. This guy's name is Ebbie Thatcher. And Ebbie Thatcher is the man that Bill Wilson credited for being his sponsor up until the day he died. So Ebbie is the one that carried the message to Bill. But I love Ebbie. He's up in New York, or up in Vermont. And what took him up to Vermont, Ebbie had all kinds of trouble with alcohol. He was always either in jail, or he was being arrested, or he was in an asylum. He had all kinds of trouble with alcohol. And a judge had pronounced Ebbie as insane. And the judge had told Ebbie, he said, "Ebbie, one more beer, and I'm going to commit you to the state mental institution for an undetermined amount of time." So if that's not a reason to give up the booze, I don't know what is. But Ebbie Thatcher's family had sent him up to Vermont to get the summer home ready for the family to come up. I love Ebbie. I can identify with his thinking. He's in this great big house, and he goes down in the basement of this great big house, and he sees this case of unopened beer. And his alcoholic mind, he sits there, and he looks at the beer, and he said, "This is a dangerous thing. It's warm up here in Vermont. And if this beer sits here and ferments, and if those kids that are going to be coming up here happen to be running around and playing in this basement, and if this beer sits here and ferments to the point that it could explode, someone could get hurt." So what was an alcoholic to do? I mean, the only reasonable thing to do was to drink the beer. He couldn't dump it. So Ebbie drank the beer. He got drunk. His story goes, he got drunk. He drove, got in his car. I'm sure you can identify with that, some of you. He got in his car, and he drove directly in through the front window of the neighbor's lady's house, and she was standing there all freaked out, and he rolled out of his car and asked her if she had the coffee on. That's Ebbie Thatcher. And Ebbie Thatcher continued to drink for just a short period of time after that. He finally got arrested again for shooting off a firearm in city limits. He was out hunting streetlights, and he got arrested for shooting off a firearm in city limits. So here he is in court again. And if you read the history books, there were three people that showed up with Abby Thatcher in court that morning. A lot of people say that court orders are new to Alcoholics Anonymous. Court orders were going around before Alcoholics Anonymous. The guy that was to become Bill's sponsor was court ordered to Alcoholics Anonymous. Basically, there was no AA at the time. But if you read the history books, there were three people that showed up with Abby Thatcher in court that morning: Roland Hazard, Siebert Graves, and Shep Cornell. And the judge looked down at Abby and he told Abby, he said, "Abby, I told you if you ever showed up in my courtroom again, I was going to commit you to the state mental institution for an undetermined amount of time." He said, "But there's a man in this courtroom this morning that I've been trying to get sober for his entire adult life. I've had no success, but that man is sober today. I have no idea how it's happened or what happened, but that man is sober today. That man is my son, Siebert Graves." The judge was the father of Siebert Graves, who Roland Hazard had gotten sober. And the judge looked down at Abby and he said, "Abby, I sentence you to go with that man," which was Roland Hazard. He said, "I sentence you to go where he goes and do what he tells you to do, and I'll withhold sentencing to the state mental institution." So I'm going to stop again right here, guys. I'm going to recap one more time so nobody gets lost. So far what we have is we have the Washingtonians. From the Washingtonians, the message went to Sam Hadley. From Sam Hadley, it went to William James, the psychiatrist who wrote the book. It went to Frank Buckman and Sam Shoemaker and the Oxford Group. It went to Harrison Hadley, down to the Bowery of New York, to the Calvary Mission. It went to Roland Hazard, to Carl Jung, back to Roland Hazard, up to Vermont, to Siebert Graves and Shep Cornell, and now to Abby Thatcher. So they took Abby Thatcher back to New York, to the Calvary Mission, and what they did was they put him out on the street corner to preach and to convert people. And one of the first people that Abby started to think about was our founder, Bill Wilson. His old friend Bill. So Abby decides that he's going to go over and visit his friend Bill, and he goes over to Bill's house, and they're sitting across the kitchen table from each other, and Bill could see that there was something different about his friend Abby. And Abby sat there and told Bill, he said, "Bill, I got religion." Bill sat there and thought to himself, "Man, I'm glad you got religion, because I got more gin, and my gin's going to outlast your religion." But it says it in the book that Abby Thatcher flatly proclaimed to Bill Wilson what came to be our 12th promise that we read at a lot of meetings today. What Abby Thatcher said was that God was doing for him what he could not do for himself. God was doing for him what he could not do for himself. So Bill, even though he's drunk at the time, he decided that he was going to go back one more time. So he goes back to Towns Hospital, where he claims he was four times. Ray O, a friend of mine out of Florida, archivist and history buff in Alcoholics Anonymous, he claims that he got to see the records for Towns Hospital. He claims Bill Wilson was in there 14 times. So I really don't know how many times Bill was in Towns Hospital. I know that it was a number of times. So Bill goes back to Towns Hospital, and he has his white flash experience, and he gets sober. And I'm not going to go through all the leading up to it, but he gets sober, and he's going down to the Bowery in New York. He's dragging people off of bar stools. He's trying to get them sober. For some reason, Bill knew. Bill had the information that the key for him to stay sober. Dr. Silkworth, the last time that Bill was in Towns Hospital, he pulled him and Lois aside. He was talking to Lois, and he said the same thing that Carl Jung had said to Roland Hazard. What Dr. Silkworth said to Lois was, he said, "You know, there's nothing we can do for your husband. No human power can relieve his alcoholism. He's either going to die in a short period of time or he's going to be committed to the state mental institution." So Bill had what was required in this program, which is a bottom. A bottom at depth is the first requirement for the first condition of sobriety in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So Bill's sober. He's out dragging drunks off bar stools. He's trying to get them sober, and he's not having any success. And a time came during that first 6 months before Bill met Dr. Bob. Bill's sobriety date is the first part of December, December 11th of 1934. But a time came during that first, and that's when we celebrate June 10th as Founders Day, because that's when Dr. Bob took his last drink, and then there was two, and Alcoholics Anonymous was formed. But I'm here to tell you that everybody's sobriety was hinging right then on what was about to be said, guys. Three most important words in all of Alcoholics Anonymous ever uttered were about to be uttered, and they weren't even uttered by an alcoholic, because Bill was talking, he went home, he was talking to his wife Lois, and he said, you know, we've done everything that we can. We've drugged people home, we've fed them, we've given them coffee, we've given them money with your meager earnings, and not one person has stayed sober. And I'm here to tell you that everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous sobriety was hinging right then on what she said, because she looked him in the eyes and she said, you did, Bill. You did, Bill. And that's important, guys. That's damn important. So anyway, Bill's 6 months sober. He's dabbling back in Wall Street. This company he's working with decides that they're going to send him to Akron. Bill goes to Akron. He meets Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob gets drunk one more time, and then he gets sober. They go out. They 12-step Bill Dotson. They didn't really know what they were doing at the time, but they got a couple other people sober as well. And after 6 months, Bill goes back to New York, and he gets a couple of people sober. So now there's a group in New York. There's a group in Akron. And a faction broke off and went out to Cleveland. Those are more links in the chain. One of the people that Bill got to work with when he went back to New York was a fellow by the name of Hank P. Hank Parkhurst. Hank P. was a big shot. He was a big wig. Hank could not stay sober, but he was a big promoter. The Big Book was actually Hank's idea. He figured that they had to pass this thing on through literature. So he told Bill one day to write his story, and right there was a solution. And what they did was they were sitting around a table in Akron in 1938, and they counted 40 people. 40 people had gotten sober and had maintained sobriety during this period of time, and they knew they were on to something. And they were sitting around that table in Akron talking about, how are we going to pass this thing on? How are we going to, excuse me, how are we going to carry this message? If we keep doing it the way we're doing it, it'll be 10 years before it gets out of Akron. So Bill, he's the big shot. He's the stockbroker with the law degree. He wanted to have a group of paid emissaries to go across the country. He also wanted to have a string of hospitals. He also wanted to name it the Bill Wilson Movement. And he also wanted to write a book. And the group conscience is starting to be formed or take effect anyway. They nixed the idea of the string of hospitals. They nixed the idea of the paid emissaries. But they gave Bill the okay to write this book. Now, I'm a guy that I believe that after having done the research that I've done, collecting archives, studying the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, that this program and our Big Book is a gift to us of answered prayers. But I believe that God wasn't always saying yes. I believe that God said no through the group conscience to the paid emissaries. And I believe that God said no through the group conscience to the string of hospitals. But Dr. Silkworth had a friend, a connection at Reader's Digest. And so this group of alcoholics, they go to Reader's Digest. Bill had written his story by now. That's the first thing we do as alcoholics, is talk about ourselves first. But Bill had written his story, and they took his story to Reader's Digest, and Reader's Digest said, man, this is great stuff. We would love to print a condensed version of this once you guys get the book written. And so they left Reader's Digest. They were very excited. They had a lot of hope. This was going to be a nationally exposed book. They had it going on. So Bill goes back, and they start writing the book. And everything that Bill is writing is being edited and being critiqued and being changed by the membership itself. And if you read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a lot of we's and ours, and it's a we program, that type of stuff. But that's not the way that the Big Book was originally written in the original manuscript. In the original manuscript, there's a lot of you's and you must and you better do this. And if you get to this point in the book and don't agree, just throw the book away. There's that type of stuff in the original manuscript. But the fellowship was critiquing him, and they were making him change everything that he was writing, and it was becoming frustrating to Bill. And I want to read you something out of chapter 5 that we read at every meeting today, and it's about the style of the writing. It's about the style of the writing when Bill was being edited and critiqued and they were making him change everything. It says this: at some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. That was the style of the writing, because they were making Bill change everything and were critiquing him. And after Bill wrote that, and after he wrote the 12 steps, Bill, in his frustration, went back to the group and he said, I will not be passing this in front of every one of you to edit this whole book. Either I write it or you write it. So they got together and they made this decision, okay, Bill, go ahead and write the book. And I want to read you something out of that very same chapter after the group made that decision. It says this: we hope that you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you from him. If you have already made a decision and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, you have made a good beginning. That being so, you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. That's the difference in the writing style between the first 5 chapters of the book and the rest of the book after they made the decision. So we have the book being written. They've gone back to Reader's Digest, but they need some money. They need some money. Bill Wilson and Hank Parkhurst are both great salesmen. These two guys could sell Playboy to a blind man. So they decide that they're going to form the 100 Men Corporation, and they're going to sell stock. This is a copy of the stock prospectus that Bill and Hank were selling, $25 a share, par value, in Alcoholics Anonymous, in a corporation that didn't exist. Is that legal? In a corporation that didn't exist. So anyway, they sold all this stuff. They got some money together. They got the book completed. They went back to Reader's Digest and they said, here it is, man, we're ready to go. We've sold all this stock in a corporation that doesn't exist. We borrowed money from here and there. Cornwell Press, we're into them for however much money for printing the book. And this is the book that came out. This is the first printing of the first edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. It came out and was printed in April of 1939. This is the only printing of the first edition big books, of any of the big books, that came out with a red hardboard cover on them. So this is what the big book looked like when it came out in April of 1939. This is what the big book looks like on August 23rd, 2025. And I know I don't need to tell any of you, District 22, San Luis Obispo County recovering alcoholics this, but I'm going to tell you anyway, this is what the big book looks like open. That's... if you don't hear anything else, that's some really useful information. So they go back to Reader's Digest. They have the book completed. Reader's Digest tells them, hey, guys, we're sorry. We've decided we're not going to print the article. So here we are, disappointed, upset, stuck. I've heard different numbers. My research is 4,650 copies of that red book. We can't do anything with them. Nobody's heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. We've got 4,650 copies of that book sitting in case boxes down in an old dilapidated rundown office in downtown New York City. And here we are, stuck. What I'm going to do now for a few minutes, guys, is I'm going to regress just a little bit. And I'm going to talk for a few minutes about what went into that book. Does anyone ever wonder about the story in the first part of the big book of the Man of 30? Neat story. Interesting story. Man of 30 knew at 30 years old that drinking was a problem in his life, so he stopped. Became very successful in business. He was owned a car dealership, actually. He became very successful in business. 20 years later, at retirement age, out came the slippers and out came the bottle. And within a short period of time, 4 years, as a matter of fact, he was dead. He was dead. That's an interesting story. But consider the fact that Bill Wilson was only 3.5 years sober when they wrote the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Where did the story of the Man of 30 come from? I'll tell you where it came from. It came out of this book right here. The name of the book is The Common Sense of Drinking. It was written by Richard Peabody and published in 1934. A lot of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous came from other people and other books. I'm going to be reading a few things here, and I'm going to get to what the contents of the big book are and where it came from. What are the sources of the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous? Bill Wilson answered that question in a address delivered to the medical profession of the state of New York on May 9th, 1944. But Bill also did a talk to the medical profession at Yale University. And the medical profession at Yale University asked Bill this question: just how does AA work? And Bill's answer was this, and I quote, "I cannot fully answer that question. Many AA techniques have been adopted after a 10-year period of trial and error, which has led to some interesting results. But as laymen, we doubt our own ability to explain them. We can only tell you what we do and what seems from our point of view to happen to us. At the very outset, we should like to make it ever so clear that AA is a synthetic gadget, as it were, drawing upon the resources of medicine, psychiatry, religion, and our own experience of drinking and recovery. You will search in vain for a single new fundamental. We have merely streamlined old and proven principles of psychiatry and religion into such forms that the alcoholic will accept them. And then we have created a society of his own kind where he can enthusiastically put these very principles to work on himself and other sufferers. Alcoholics Anonymous has made two major contributions to the programs of psychiatry and religion. These are, it seems to us, the long missing links in the chain of recovery. Number one, our ability as ex-drinkers to secure the confidence of the new man, to build a transmission line into him, and number two, the provision of an understanding society of ex-problem drinkers in which the newcomer can successfully apply the principles of medicine and religion to himself and others." So what Bill was saying here is very little, and our big book is original. Our big book was taken from many, many different books. But where did the big book come from? This book right here is called Man the Unknown. It was written in 1935 by a fellow by the name of Alex Corral. Man the Unknown by Alex Corral. What Bill wrote about this book was he said this. And again, I quote, "On reading this book, Man the Unknown, some of us realized that was just what we had been groping towards. We had begun to build a program out of our own experiences. At this point, we thought, let's reach into other people's experiences. Let's go back to our friends, the preachers, the social workers, and all those who have been concerned with us, and again, review what they have and bring it into synthesis. And let us, where we can, bring them in where they fit. So our process of trial and error began, and at the end of 4 years, the material was cast in the form of a book known as Alcoholics Anonymous." So the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was actually cast out of Man the Unknown by Alex Corral. There are other books. This book right here is called Sermon on the Mount, and it was written by Emmett Fox, and all the early AA members would go and listen to Emmett. He did talks and inspirational readings on his book around New York, and the early AAs would go listen to Emmett. We've already talked about The Varieties of Religious Experience, written by William James and published in 1902. Another book that Bill had read that became a very important part of the big book was this one right here. It's called As Man Thinketh. It was written in 1910 by James Allen. This is the book that basically the concept of step four comes from. In this book, James Allen writes that our problems are basically of our own making. This book basically says that we are what we think. It says in this book that we must learn to crucify ourselves on a daily basis. Thus, the core AA idea is that we must get down to causes and conditions. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making, that some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas and the result was nil until we let go. All of those profound sayings that are in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous came out of this book right here, As Man Thinketh. This book right here is called What is the Oxford Group? It was written by the layman with a notebook. This is basically the Oxford Group's big book. This book talks about the four absolutes there, and then it talks about the four steps. I believe they had absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. And then the four steps of the program were they shared their sins with other people, other Christians, just step five in our program. Restitution to all they had harmed, which is steps 8 and 9 in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Listening to and accepting and relying on God's guidance in all their affairs, which is the rest of the spiritual steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So the Oxford group was huge in the formation of the thought process in Alcoholics Anonymous. This book right here is called Twice Born Men. It was written by Harold Bigby and published in 1909. This is all stories of drunks who had gotten sober through a religious conversion experience. See if these titles sound familiar. The Criminal, The Copper Basher, Lowest of the Lows, Rags and Bones. This is the apparent failure. This is the book that gave Bill the idea for us to put our own stories of our own personal experience in the back of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Again, The Common Sense of Drinking, written by Richard Peabody and published in 1934, 4 years before the big book was written. There are other statements in that book, in The Common Sense of Drinking. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Half measures are no avail, and perhaps the entire story of the man of 30 all came out of The Common Sense of Drinking, written by Richard Peabody. This book right here is called The Way of Life. It was written by William Osler and published in 1937. I don't think, guys, that it's a coincidence that the book that we read today, As Bill Sees It, in its original form, was called The AA Way of Life. This is the book that gave Bill the idea for us to live our lives one day at a time. And there's a quote in this book, and this is interesting. It says this: our lives are like a great ocean liner. Does that sound familiar? I don't want to use the word plagiarize, guys, but on the first page of chapter 2, there is a solution. It says we are passengers in a great freight liner. But Bill had read all of these books. Bill was a sponge. There's a few other books, but Bill was a sponge for knowledge on alcoholism. And what Bill was saying was our book was taken from many, many different books and many, many different people. It was taken from William Silkworth, a doctor who loved drunks. It was taken from Carl Jung. It was taken from the Oxford group and the four absolutes and the different people and tenets and beliefs in the Oxford group. So so that was huge in the formation of the thought process. So we have the book written. At this point, we're sitting on 4,650 copies of this book and these red books, and we can't do anything with them. Reader's Digest has already said they weren't going to print the article, but some things began to happen. Some things began to happen. In late September of 1939, September 30th of 1939, an article came out in this magazine right here. The name of the article, the name of the magazine is the Liberty Magazine. The title of the article was Alcoholics and God. It was written by a fellow by the name of Morris Markey. And what that article did was it caused about 500 of these red books to sell. Caused about 500 of these red books to sell. But we still didn't have enough money to keep this thing going. In February of 1940, Bill, through relatives, had a connection with the Rockefellers. And the Rockefellers hosted this dinner, and the drunks went to this dinner, and I believe that this is another time of God saying no. But the Rockefellers hosted this. If it hadn't have been for this dinner, and it hadn't have been for these words that the Rockefellers sent back, we might not be sitting here this afternoon either, guys, because Bill was going to go out and sell this thing. There's a stock for certificates to prove it. But the drunk Rockefellers hosted this dinner. The drunks went to the dinner, and they told their stories. Mr. Rockefeller Sr. wasn't there, but his son Nelson was. And the Rockefeller sent back this message that basically saved Alcoholics Anonymous. And the message was, won't money spoil this? Won't money spoil this? And the Rockefellers pledged $5,000 for Bill and for Dr. Bob to pay off his mortgage and for Bill and Dr. Bob to get a stipend to carry on their work. And they carried it on, and they were just absolutely broke when something else broke through. And I'm going to talk this morning about an event that happened in between the Liberty Magazine article that came out and the Saturday Evening Post article that came out. It's an event that I think was just as important as either one of those two magazine articles. Doesn't get talked about very often, but I think it was very important. It's a baseball story. And baseball fans in here? There was a young pitcher back then that could throw. He's a pitching phenomenon. He could throw fastball faster than any other pitcher in the league, a guy by the name of Bob Feller. Bob Feller. And there was a catcher that would catch for him. He was a drunk. He would go from team to team, and he would catch for Bob Feller. And this guy's name is Raleigh H. Raleigh Hemsley. Happened to be AA number 77 out of the first 100. But Raleigh just happened to be on the team in Cleveland when Bob Feller, the young pitching phenomenon, threw two no-hitters. And if you're the catcher that catches the pitcher that throws two no-hitters, you get a little bit of press yourself. Raleigh caught those two games, and he's being interviewed by a group of sports reporters. And one of the sports reporters says to Raleigh, he says, Raleigh, something's a little bit different about you. What is it? And Raleigh answered that question like this. He said, well, I just want you fellas to know that I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for a year. And that headline, the sports page of the Cleveland Plains Dealer, April 17th, 1940. April 17th, 1940. Big headlines, a year without a drink. The Associated Press picked the story up from there, and it made it through other newspapers across the country. But that did several things, I believe, for Alcoholics Anonymous. Number one was it went public. Another thing it did was it let people know that young people could get sober, stay sober. It let people know that successful people, you didn't have to be a Skid Row wino. Raleigh was a catcher for a professional baseball team. Successful people could get sober and stay sober. So basically, along the same times as the Saturday Evening Post and the Liberty Magazine article, that was probably just as important as either one of those two. And back then, just for information, there was no tradition of anonymity, so it was okay for him to do that for you old-timers that are going to argue with me about that after this meeting. So, it's okay. Jack Alexander was a journalist, a reporter for the Saturday Evening Post. And Jack Alexander's intent was that he was going to expose Alcoholics Anonymous as the fraud that he thought it was his original intent. And Jack Alexander went to Akron, and he went to some meetings in Akron, and he met the membership, and he met the fellowship, and he saw the work in Alcoholics Anonymous and the success in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened was Jack Alexander fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. He fell in love with the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. He fell in love with the work in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he wrote an article that came out in that magazine right over there, March 1st, 1941, Saturday Evening Post. And it was a glowing article. It was about the success of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was about the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And out of that article came 10,000 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was out of that article, according to Bill Wilson, that AA became a national pastime. And it was out of that article that AA exploded all over the country. I'm going to start wrapping this thing up pretty quick, guys. The rest is all history. The foreword to the second edition of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is probably our best condensed written history that we have. What's happened over the years, guys, is there was that red book, the first printing of the first edition. From that book, there were 16 printings of the first edition. 16 printings of the first edition. People say that nothing in the big book has changed, and that is simply not true. Every printing of the first 16 printings is different. Words are different. Statistics are different. Things changed in the big book. I have them, and I've read them. So there were 16 printings of the first edition. In 1955, the second edition came. There were 16 printings of the second edition. In 1976, the third edition came. There were 76 printings of the third edition. 76 printings of the third edition. In 2001, the fourth edition came. And I want to say that we are now on our 55th printing of the fourth edition. 55th printing of the fourth edition. To date, the big book is printed in 73 different languages. 73 different languages. The Spanish language is the first foreign language that the big book was printed in, and that was in 1957. And as of today, guys, there has been approximately 43,079,226 copies of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous printed in 73 different languages. I love that book. And where that takes us, guys, is back to the links in the chain and something that I believe is so true. Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, has a quote handwritten on the front page of her diary, of her journal. And it's a quote by Carl Sandburg. And what that quote says is, whenever any civilization or society perishes, there is always one condition present. They forgot where they came from. And I believe that's as true today as the day that it was written. After having done the research that I've done, collecting archives and studying the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, guys, I don't think that we're all that much different than the Washingtonians who simply lost their way. I think we have more experience, and our experience has taught us. But I also think that if we're not careful and take care of our singleness of purpose, and take care of our traditions, that we could lose our way as well. I would like to close with something that really doesn't have anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, but yet it has everything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. In one of the archival magazines that I've collected, there's a prize fighter of the time, Jack Dempsey. And Jack Dempsey's getting ready to get in the ring for a title fight. He's being interviewed by a sports reporter. And again, this doesn't really have anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, but I think it has everything to do with it. He's being interviewed by this sports reporter, and the sports reporter asks him, he says, okay, Jack, what's it going to take to win this fight? What's it going to take to win this fight? And Jack Dempsey answered that question like that. He said, when we get to this level, and I relate that to us in Alcoholics Anonymous, when we get to this level and we're in AA, he said, we all have pretty much equal ability. He said, whoever's the hungriest is going to come out the winner. So my hope and my prayer for us that are here in this meeting and attending this convention this weekend, if you're not hungry, you get hungry. If you are hungry, you stay hungry. You take care of our singleness of purpose, and you take care of our traditions, and you pass this thing on. Again, I would like to thank the 58th Annual District 22 Conference Committee for members for asking me to share with you. It's been a great honor for me to stand up here and tell AA's story. I'm just honored. And I would like to thank Natalie L. again, Craig A., Bob R., Dan O. for coordinating me. It's been a year-long thing, guys. You guys put a lot of work into coordinating me coming speaking here. And I'd like to take a minute to say a few special thank yous. I'd like to thank Nick and Teresa for helping me with the archive display over there. I don't know if you guys realize this or not, but I love talking about this stuff. So, you know, come by over there if you want to. But I'd like to thank, there's been some people, I got some friends here that have traveled up from Area 07, the mighty District 33 where I'm from. So, you know, I'd like to thank everybody for coming. So thank all of you for coming, guys. And where did the links in the chain end up? And we'll just close it with this. It started in the 1840s with the Washingtonians. It went to 1895 to Sam Hadley. From Sam Hadley, it went to William James, the psychiatrist who wrote the book. It went to Frank Buckman and Sam Shoemaker and the Oxford Group. It went to Harrison Hadley, the Calvary Mission. It went to Harrison Hadley and the Calvary Mission. It went to Roland Hazard, to Siebert Graves, to Shep Cornell, to Ebbie Thatcher, back down to New York, to our founder, Bill Wilson. From Bill, it went to Bob. From Bill and Bob, it went to Bill Dodson and Ernie G and Phil S., Florence Rankin, some of the early members in Akron. It went from New York to Akron, back to New York, out to Cleveland, out to Chicago. From there, it came out here to California, guys. The message came out to California. The first recordings of Alcoholics Anonymous in California, down in Southern Cal, Long Beach first, guys. From Long Beach, the message came up here to Central California, and the starting 58 years ago of the District 22 Convention Committee. And all of those links in the chain got up this morning, August 23rd, 2025. We all came here to San Luis Obispo. We came here to the Veterans Center in San Luis Obispo. We came trudging the road of happy destiny into this room an hour ago, and we sat down and we took our seats. And every one of us that are in this meeting this morning and attending this convention this weekend is a miracle in the chain of recovery, and we are all connected from here to way back there, and we are all one. Alcoholics Anonymous, God bless. Absolutely. What else do you need?
Nothing, don't let go.
You got it?
Got it.
Absolutely.